From the studios of KPCW, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our impacts upon it. I'm Claire Wiley, and joining me this morning is special guest host Cheryl Fox. Now, Cheryl, as many of you know out there, is the chief executive officer of the Summit Land Conservancy, and she was instrumental in helping form the organization in 1998 and was its very first employee. Cheryl, thank you for co-hosting today on This Green Earth.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here.
Well, we're so happy to have you here, and you've been so instrumental in our community, talking about conservation, talking about environmental impact, talking about all those topics that matter. And so I was excited to have you come and co-host with us today because of your vast knowledge in this zone.
Well, thank you very much. It has been my honor to be part of the conversation around land conservation in the Park City area initially, and then all across the Wasatch Back, and to work with so many other wonderful individuals and organizations and governments to really actually, I think, preserve some of the places that are most important to our communities. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and you have done a wonderful job at that. So welcome this morning. And we're also looking forward to speaking with Utah State University Professor Darren Perry and biologist and author Tor Hansen.
Darren Perry is the former chairman of the Shoshone Nation. He teaches at the University of Utah and Utah State University. He's the author of a book called The Bear River Massacre and has created a nonprofit organization as well. Darren's work highlights the deep connection between the Shoshone people and the land, and he shares how traditional practices reflect sustainability and environmental stewardship in a very wise and soulful way.
Wonderful. I can't wait to talk to Darren. And then in the second part of the show, we share with you an interview that Chris Cherniak and I did, that guy, our co-host. And we talked with biologist and author Tor Hansen, whose book, Close to Home, is actually being released today. And we had an earlier conversation with him. And in the book, Hansen shares ways in which to see nature through a different lens, giving all of us a new perspective on its many wonders. He also walks us through different ways we can contribute to science and improve the health of our planet. All that is coming up and more today on This Green Earth. We have with us right now Darren Perry, who is the former chairman of the Shoshone Nation and who teaches Native American history at Utah State University. Darren, thank you so much for being a part of our show today.
It's a pleasure to join you. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Darren.
So yeah, I'm the former chairman of the Shoshone Nation, but I grew up in Utah my whole life, and I attended the University of Utah and ended up graduating from Weber State. And I grew up at the feet of a grandmother who taught me all about my culture, but especially about the Bear River Massacre, one of the largest massacre of natives in the history of our country. And so I developed this great love for my culture. I'd go on walks out by Antelope Island. So the importance of the Great Salt Lake was instilled in me as a child. And I just grew up looking at the world through a different lens. And so I'm a little older now, and I've taken many journeys in this life, but I'm grateful that the last few years I've been able to advocate for not only the Great Salt Lake, but for open spaces and things of that nature. I ran for Congress during the pandemic. Blake Moore's our congressman now, and I ran as a Democrat, so you know how that turned out for me. But so grateful for Summit County. It was the only county I won. And so I think there's a lot of like-minded people that live there. And I just turned in a manuscript for a second book called Tending the Sacred, How Indigenous Wisdom Will Save the World. And it has a lot to do with our environmental stewardship. So I'm just grateful that I've been on this journey of discovery for myself, but it's led me back to the principles my grandmother taught me as a child of our sacred stewardship to this earth. So it's an honor to be able to talk to you guys for a few minutes.
Well, can you start with sharing with us how historically the Shoshone people lived on the land and what that relationship looked like?
Yes, I'd love to because it's such an important topic. I mean, when I'd go on these walks with my grandmother, it was magical. She'd point out plants, whether they were used as food or medicine. She'd pick up a rock and actually have a conversation with it. And so I grew up looking at the world as these natural resources that we call them today, the plants, the animals, the rocks, the land. She always referred to them as our non-human kinfolk. And so I grew up looking at all of those natural resources as a relative. And when you look at the world through that way, that lens, and you realize that you're not at the top of the hierarchy, that you're just part of the ecosystem and a delicate part as that. So I just grew up looking at the world different. I didn't exploit it. I didn't as much as I could in the current system that we have, but I looked at the world as a relative that needs to be nurtured and cared for just as we would a grandmother or a favorite cousin. And when you look at the world that way, and I think you make your decisions in a better way. And so we don't look at it as something to exploit for the sake of short-term profits. And our steps are lighter. And I just think we do better when we look at the world as a sacred being that has as many rights as we do to exist, that we can have a conversation with, that we can look in the eyes and sit down by a creek and have a chat with a tree. I mean, all of those things were instilled in me as a child. And so I still try to instill those value systems into my grandchildren.
Darren, when you are teaching these the classes to university students, what's their reaction?
That's such a good question, and I'm glad you asked it because my class is called Indigenous Land Stewardship. We talk about how the current system's probably not sustainable. And I'm being kind here. So, but the system of extraction and depletion isn't sustainable. But how Native Americans moved through this environment and ecosystem for thousands of years without messing it up. And so, and it's not because there weren't very many of us, there were millions and millions that lived here. And so, my students, in fact, I had a student at the University of Utah. She was graduating in sociology, and she said at the end of the semester, "I cannot believe I have been through this whole educational process and I have never known any of this. And this has never been exposed to me, that there might be a different way to look at the environment and look at our stewardship and not only look at it as a dream." I mean, I actually try to teach it in a way that gives us reason for hope, that gives us a way to make a difference. So it's much more than just here's how, you know, it was, but it's more about what can we do. And I'm so much more about that. And that's kind of what my new book's going to talk about is how can we take the good of science and innovation, but pair it with this traditional ecological knowledge that's been out there for thousands of years. And how can we collaborate and do it better? Because I think that's what it's going to take. I think, you know, when people assume that scientific knowledge and innovation is superior to indigenous wisdom, I think you make collaboration impossible. And I think that's what it's going to take going forward. But my students love it. I mean, it's really popular. They just learn to look at the world in a slightly different way and in a way that honors the earth.
And speaking to that, it's like this idea that everything is intertwined, which seems to invoke the idea that we're connected and we'll be better stewards and treat things differently because we have that connection. Why do you think people have moved so far away from that, and how do we get them to adopt those ideas again? Because it seems in the Western world that humans are paramount, and we don't see ourselves as part of the land, but we're kind of on top of it, and as a result, there are some destructive behaviors around that. How do you think that we shift that mindset?
Yeah, that's a really tough one, because all I hear from our current state leaders and national leaders is exploitation, drill, drill, drill. How can we take that piece of property over there and extract it, deplete it, develop it for the sake of short-term profits? And sadly, today we measure our success by economic growth and growth at all costs. Look, I'm not anti-growth at all, but I'm the right growth. We live in a state that has just a limited amount of water. I don't care. All the innovation in the world isn't going to create more water. And in a world that's getting hotter and climate change, those are things we can't really factor in every year. We just don't know. But I know there's a limited amount of water, so we can't keep just building and building and building. And I'm not sure what the answer is. I don't know if our leaders have the courage to make the tough decisions that, you know, say, look, just because that land is over there and your system says I can take it, I can extract it, deplete it, develop it for the sake of short-term profits, maybe we should start asking ourselves, just because we can, should we? And if we do, at what cost is it going to come to future generations? You know, just injecting that into at the end of a sentence when we're talking about economic growth, but what is it going to do to the future generations, our kids and grandkids, who are going to pay the price of more traffic, more air pollution, depleted water systems? And so we've got to start governing like the Iroquois did. You know, they had a 7 generations. All of their decisions considered what it would do to 7 generations ahead. And I don't know if our leaders have the stomach to make those tough decisions. But one day, and I'm not I don't think the earth is going to just crash and burn all at once, but one day we're going to pay a price for it. And the world is going to reset itself. And I just, whether we want it to or not, it's not going to extinct us, but it's going to change how we do things going forward. And so I hope we can start making smarter decisions that will mitigate some of our extractive and depletive and, you know, efforts that our leaders seem to really highlight.
I'd like to ask you to elaborate a little bit on the idea that you just touched on about how, you know, Western thought tends to value what we can put a number on. And very often that's a dollar number. And when we start talking about the values of land conservation, for example, clean water, clean air, wildlife, a thriving ecosystem, and the future generations, it's harder to put a number on those things. Is there a way, or is there a way to rephrase, relook at value that you found in the wisdom that you're sharing?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because if you don't get out and experience it, if you're sitting in a cubicle and all you do when you get home is scroll through your phone, and if that's your life, you're never going to be able to see the changes that we need to make. And so I tell my students, put down your phone and go on a hike today, get out in nature, sit by a tree and have a conversation with it. It's only when we get out and really explore those natural, beautiful things that are in our environment, are we really going to be able to see the value in it and see the value of what we are going to lose. If you are profit-minded and get ahead at all costs, you're going to miss all of those wonderful things that we have to offer. And I mean, we live in the most beautiful state in the world, I think, and I travel around quite a bit. Just the diversity is just magnificent. And so I know what we stand to lose if we don't change our ways. And I guess I developed this class to kind of give students the opportunity to say, oh, no, wait a minute. There's a different way to look at the problem. And I go to a lot of elementary schools too. And while I don't hammer on them about environmental policies and environmental justice issues, I certainly, through storytelling and other ways, inject a different way to look at the world that they live in. And when students are able to do that, you know, the magic happens. And so I look in their eyes and I see hope for me, because I think they want to live in a world that's clean, where the air's clean and the water's clean, and they have enough water and they can take a walk in the mountains and still enjoy that beautiful views and vistas that we all enjoy today. But we've got to get outside and we've got to explore the wonderful things we have around us. Otherwise, we're not going to make it.
Darren, given the history of the Bear River Massacre, it's really inspiring and interesting to hear you talk so much about hope. Can you talk about how your history and your the delving into history, the storytelling of history, has brought you to that perspective?
Yeah, my grandmother would take me to the massacre site, which is 11 miles over the Utah-Idaho border, next to Preston, Idaho, largest massacre of Native Americans in the history of our country. And just growing up and hearing these stories, and I write a book about it, and it's just taught me to change the way I look at things. I can't change what happened, so that's a given. But I can change the way how I approach it and how we can learn from it. And the massacre's taught me many lessons about life over the years. It's taught me that bad things happen to people. They're going to happen to all of us inevitably. But how we respond to those events determines our character. You know, it's taught me to offer unconditional forgiveness, but it doesn't mean we need to forget. But it's also taught me that we just need to take these hard issues that we all go through and look at them in the way that, how can I learn from it? And how can we move forward, making this world a better place for all of us, using hard events like that, using events from the past to learn from, and not to lament over, or for me to hold that over your heads, you know, and hit you with it in the face every 5 minutes. It's, look, we can't change it, but we can certainly learn from it. And what can we do together going forward to make it better? And we've really, you know, once we purchased all of that massacre site in 2018, we started a restoration project to restore the land to what it looked like in 1863. And so that land restoration work is ongoing. It's just been amazing. We've had many community partnerships, and we do tree planting every November, and we have over 400 show up each day in November when we do those tree plantings, and we planted over 50,000 cottonwoods and willows. We're just restoring and healing the earth in a way that would make our people proud, in a way that our people used to live in. So we just got to start learning from hard things and doing things a little different going forward.
One last question, Darren. One of the beautiful things about the book, and I agree, I felt the same way with your student. I thought, how did I not know this? Because I'm an avid student of history myself. One of the interesting things for me about the book was the story of the massacre itself, but then also the story of survival of the Shoshone Nation after the massacre. And the most beautiful thing to me was how the book ends with your grandmother's journals of the plants in the area and how those were used.
Yeah, my grandmother, I inherited all of her notes, and she'd been a boarding school survivor, but she went on to get a college degree in English, and she started writing down all of the stories and the history of our culture and our people. And because of that, we have a large volume of things that really enrich our lives. And I tried to include as much of that in my book as I could. And in the back, in the appendage, is a plant diary that my grandmother had. But she also explained how the plants were used, whether they was used as a food source or a medicine. And if it was a medicine, what they actually treated. And so it was important for me to include that so people could see the medicines are still out there. These food sources are still out there. And one of the things my nonprofit tries to highlight is food sovereignty. We have everything that we need growing in the mountains next to us. And we could live sustainably for a long time by just going on a hike and identifying plants that are used as food and medicine. And so that was such an important part. And it's going to be an important part for me going forward to bring back these food systems and maybe open a restaurant one day that only serves indigenous food. I mean, how cool would that be?
We'll go. Very cool.
Yes, we'll definitely come. Now, I've heard you say that we are not owners of the land, but we are caretakers of it. And you had alluded to that in the very beginning, that you look at the land as a relative. And in living in that manner, it seems that you don't extract or take too much, but that you take enough to survive, but then you're also replenishing in some ways. How do we get back to that state of mind of restoration? And is that possible? You spoke of hope, and I like to end on a note of hope and how we move forward.
I think it's a relationship called reciprocity. It's a give and take. We need to view the world in a way that not only are we taking what we need. It makes me crazy to see how much we think we need, but taking what we need and then giving back. I remember just going on a plant walk with my grandmother and harvesting choke cherries. She'd take a few and leave a few. And I asked her one day, why are you leaving them? Why don't you strip that whole branch clean of choke cherries? And she said, I'm leaving them for those who couldn't make it to the mountain that day, or I'm leaving them for our bird relatives. And I just started looking at things differently. And so we've got to be able to get back to looking at things that way. Reciprocity, giving and taking. And if we can't give back, then we give thanks and give gratitude. You know, if I harvest a deer, I'm not giving its life back, but I can certainly give gratitude and thank the creator for allowing that and thanking the animal for sacrificing its life. So living a life of reciprocity, I think, is the best thing I can tell people.
Well, we love that message. And Darren, we thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth today. Darren Perry, who is a professor and teaches Native American history at the Utah State University and has written a couple books. And your new book coming up is Tending the Sacred. Is that correct?
Yeah, Tending the Sacred, How Indigenous Wisdom Will Save the World. It's going to be a little bit before it comes out because the publisher just decided they want to do it and pursue it. And it might take 6 months to a year to get out, but
well, we look forward to having
it'll be
you on
around.
The show when that comes out. And hopefully we can have you on the show again. We appreciate you, Darren. Thank you so much for being part of This Green Earth.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you. It's good to talk to you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
And joining us is author and biologist Tor Hansen. He's here to talk about his new book, just coming out, Close to Home, The Wonders of Nature Just Outside Your Door. Tor, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Well, thank you. It's so great to be back with you guys.
Well, yes, we chatted with you about a month or so ago. And if you'll indulge us and indulge our listeners, take a minute or two and give us a little background on yourself and how you got started in the world of biology, conservation biology.
Yes. Well, I should say I was definitely the kid with, you know, the dirty feet and the dirty hands and the terrarium full of snakes and so forth. I always loved nature when I was younger. And also had an interest in writing. So I did an undergraduate degree that combined ecology and writing, sort of a double major. And from there, I really pursued the ecology side of things with conservation biology, in part because I was really concerned by the development around the area where I went to school. I went to school in Southern California, coming from the Pacific Northwest in a more rural setting. And I was shocked and horrified to see so much natural area at that time being swallowed up by urban sprawl. And so it really, I was always interested in nature, but that really sparked not just an interest, but a way, a desire to do something about it, you know, to do something to conserve nature. So that got me into the conservation biology world and a bunch of various research projects and the graduate degrees and so forth that go along with that and academia and so on. But all along, I still had that communication drive. I wanted to be doing some writing and translating some of these fascinating and wonderful ideas I was encountering in the scientific community that never seemed to make it beyond, you know, our relatively limited, very important, but limited audience of peer-reviewed publications. And so I started doing more interpreting science for a broader audience by writing popular books and doing some lectures and various media things that go along with that. And over the last decade or so, that part of my career has sort of taken over, and I'm focused more or less full-time on writing and communicating and being what I like to think of as a storyteller of science.
Well, you've written a number of books, including books about seeds and bees, and even feathers, which we have. If we have a few minutes, I want to dig into that one too. But all of those can be found in our backyard, and so maybe that's an entree into this book that's just really close to home: the wonders of nature just outside your door. So give us a thumbnail sketch about what this book is about.
Well, I can tell you this book started with what, for a biologist, was an extremely embarrassing moment. And that was when I realized, you know, after all of this field work in various places around the world, and as you say, writing books about this topic or that topic and so on and so forth, and I had an experience we've probably all had, a sad one. I've heard a bird hit the window of my little shack, my office where I work, which is in our backyard, and I ran outside to see, and the poor creature unfortunately had perished. But I was amazed that this is a bird I'd never seen in my yard. You know, this was a hermit thrush, which is a famous and wonderful bird for its beautiful song, and it's in hundreds of poems and so on and so forth. And here it was, a creature that's famous to biologists and famous in writing, my two chosen careers, and I had no idea that it was in the shrubs outside my doorstep. And I thought, well, God, what else am I missing? I don't even know what's in my backyard. What am I doing writing all these books about the rest of the world? I don't even know what's here. And so it really sparked in me this desire to just dive in, to retrain my eyes first to see what's in my yard, because I think we tend to overlook the things that become sort of part of the background of our lives. And then to explore that yard and find out, A, what's there, and B, what's it doing. And then the third thing would be to do what we can to help it, right? I mean, how can I make my yard better for wildlife? Well, the first thing I did, of course, was get some bird tape on that window, and I haven't had a bird strike since. But there are many other simple things, of course, that you can do in even a very tiny piece of habitat in your yard or your neighborhood or a park or a schoolyard or what have you, to make it more amenable to wildlife. So that's what the book is about: exploring the backyard, retraining our eyes to see what's there and appreciate it and be fascinated by it, and also what can we do to help it.
And I love the thought that everyone can be their own citizen scientist and try to understand better the ecology of their backyard and what's going on in their environment and their responsibility to it as well. And feeling like if we are inhabiting this space, we're inhabiting it with these creatures and with all that makes up this environment, and how we can contribute to the health of our own small little backyards.
Yeah, I mean, it's a personal reconnection in a sense, with the natural world, because we live in this, you know, increasingly indoor media and tech focused society, but we're still surrounded by nature, even in places where you wouldn't think there was much happening. We're still surrounded by nature. And so this is a way to reconnect. And with, and for those who choose, it's also, it's not just the narrow focus, but with some of the citizen science tools that are out there now, your observations, your backyard observations, can contribute to answering huge questions, you know, huge scientific questions. And so that is another aspect, and in a sense, one of the surprises for me, you know, going into this research, was realizing, hey, it's our own backyards, but it's also part now of a real broad scientific movement to combine these observations and ask some really cool questions.
And I'm not sure if you mentioned this, but where is your backyard?
Yes, I live in the Pacific Northwest. So when I run outside to save a bird in the yard, I'm looking out at a world of big Douglas fir trees and, you know, shrubs of various sorts and spirea and salmonberry and things like that. And so it's a very wet and forested part of the country.
Okay, so you had that unfortunate learning experience about birds in your backyard. Did you discover other things with respect to plants in the backyard, or maybe insects that you didn't know were there?
It's outrageous what we don't know. It's outrageous. One of the things that I did that was so eye-opening was to reenact a scientific experiment, a project that was taking place, of all places, in Los Angeles, right? Mm-hmm. And it's one of, again, just one of these great stories that I think deserves more attention. But there was this project called the BioScan Project in LA, and it started at a luncheon. You know, here was a luncheon at the Museum of Natural History there. They had their donors in. They were doing one of these, you know, fun events. And the head of the entomology department there, the curator, Brian Brown, said he sort of started bragging to, you know, one of the donors, and he said I could find a new species of insect anywhere. I could find one in your backyard. And she said, you're on. And she said, you're on. You find a species in my backyard, I'm going to throw a big fundraising dinner party to celebrate. You know, it'll be a big deal for the museum. And she said, in fact, I'm going to schedule that dinner party right now, and so you'd better get busy. And so he said, oh God, you know, all right. She called my bluff. And so he went out and he set up an insect trap, and it was just a few weeks before this party was going to happen, and he was like, oh, I hope I get something. And he got, you know, it's called a malaise trap, but it's not really malaise as in, you know, the bad. There was, you know, the guy whose last name was Malaise invented it. So you can imagine it's a, like a sheet of real thin sort of netting, and any insect flying along is going to bump into this thing, and if it goes up, it can be collected there in a little jar. And so he had this little jar of insects that had flown through her yard, and he started looking through the jar, and he was specifically looking for his specialty, which is a certain family of flies. And he said, oh, there's one. And he pulled it out, and he looked at the microscope, and he said, I'd never seen that before in my life. And he had a new species, the very first thing he pulled out of the jar. And then the next couple from his family that he was particularly interested in, one was a European species that hadn't been seen in North America, and another one was a species that had never been caught west of the Rocky Mountains. So, I mean, just in three or four samples, he said, I had enough information for the party already, you know. But it dawned on him then how much biodiversity there was right there in L.A. Because here's a guy who has been traveling the world collecting insects, and he said, well, what would we find if we just did it here? And so they collaborated with homeowners, with school groups, and so on and so forth, and they set up this very simple trap in backyards all over LA, and they've already found, there are still thousands of specimens to sort and identify, but they've already discovered more than 50 new species. So I looked at that, I read that paper, I called Brian and also one of his colleagues, Emily Hartop. And I said, can I do this in my yard? You know, will you help? Will you coach me through this? And they were gracious enough to give me some advice. And so it was just an astounding diversity of insects from collecting just in my own backyard in that way.
That's incredible, and also very inspiring, right? For those of us listening, like, yeah, that maybe we need to get a malaise. I need to find a malaise trap or so on Amazon and set one up and see what we discover, because discoveries can also be in our backyard. I was thinking not just ecological based, maybe plants and animals, but maybe it's geological. Maybe there's a certain geology that you want to learn more about in your backyard, or maybe it's the soil chemistry. If you have a microscope, you can scoop up a teaspoon of soil and discover, you know, a million different things in that. So exploration can go in a number of different dimensions, in a number of different directions.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, what are the rocks? What's the soil? In fact, your soil example is another astounding story. There's a group in Oklahoma that was doing this research, these chemists, biochemists and so forth, and they were interested in finding new compounds from fungi. And where do you find fungi? Well, they're in the soil. I mean, they're everywhere, but there are a lot of them in the soil. And so these scientists said, well, what if we could get people, maybe a few people would send us soil from their yards, because we don't have the funding to go out and collect it, right? And so they thought they'd get a few. People heard about this, and they got thousands of contributions from all over the place, just sending in, you know, a little container, like a thimble full of, a couple of thimbles full of soil from the yard. And it's all backyard soils. Just whatever you got, you know, send it to us, and we'll take a look. And they start, you know, growing out samples of the fungi that are living there. And I mean, you can just get down on the ground wherever you are and you start digging around real careful, like, and you will see these whitish little strands of various soil fungi that are holding that whole thing together. And so they would get, you know, some cases 5, 10, even 15, 20 different kinds of fungus from one little sample. And they were seeing what sorts of compounds those fungi were making and then testing them for various uses, right? Making, in a sense, a library of chemical compounds from backyard soils. Mm-hmm. And again, it's just they're just scratching the tip of the iceberg, but they had this soil sample from Alaska, and they found this amazing chemical in there that in early trials is now on track to be tested. It's a very promising breast cancer drug. So that's amazing. Sit still from the same one. It's from one soil sample from one yard in Alaska. And there's other weird compound in there. Well, what does this do? And they realized that they had found like the ultimate natural de-stinkifying agent, in that if you take this molecule and you expose it to, say, the smell of a skunk, you know, the skunk smell, which is extremely strong, it will just absolutely make that smell disappear in a second. It's just gone. This molecule that just grabs onto other molecules and nullifies the effects. And so this is just from one soil sample. And now that product is on its way. I mean, you can imagine the people who make kitty litter and so forth were pretty excited about this. So that product is on its way to, you know, to help you with the smell of the cats in your house, while this other product from one soil sample is potentially going to save lives.
I always thought that it was very fascinating to me to see how, if you're looking for something natural or a way in which to work around something, you can usually find a solution in nature if you look hard enough. And I love the idea that any one of us could be a part of that. What are some examples of experiments that you would suggest for our listeners?
Oh, it really depends upon what people, you know, what their interests are. But here in the two we've already talked about, you know, we've talked about something as simple as gathering a bit of soil from your yard and sending it to a scientist and seeing what has, you know, what's in there, which is fascinating. Some people are very adept with their cell phones, and they like to, you know, enter data through something like an eBird sort of application, where every bird that you enter into your list becomes part of a massive data set.
Chris Cherniak.
There's another one that's very popular now called iNaturalist, where people use for the plants, they use, you know, insects, even birds, and so on and so forth, taking pictures and trying to get something identified. And that's an interesting example in that one of the founders, the early people involved with iNaturalist, was a graduate student at Stanford who was studying climate change and, you know, had this model that was predicting how, you know, the change in climate was changing the potential ranges of species, right? And meaning that they were becoming disassociated from, say, the protected areas that were supposed to protect them, right? Joshua trees leaving Joshua Tree National Park or what have you, that kind of disconnect. And so he had this paper that was doing, you know, getting a lot of attention, and people kept asking, well, where are species moving? What's happening? What's happening on the ground? And he said, well, we don't have any data. And then he got involved in this iNaturalist project because he realized in part that every time someone out there with a cell phone takes a picture of you know, a wildflower they can't identify and they want someone to identify it, you have a location, you have a date stamp, time stamp, and you have a picture of a species. You have data. And so you amplify that, you expand that to the number of data points that are being entered into a program like that. And once you have them identified, the species identified, and they have a process for doing that, all of that data now is getting uploaded into something called GBIF, the Global Biodiversity Index Fund or whatever it is. It's a multinational database for just that kind of information. And scientists are drawing on it all the time now to study climate change. Where are species moving? Where are species ranges shifting? And other questions as well. And what's really cool about it to me is that citizen-gathered data is just part of the scientific firmament. Scientists, many of the scientists using that, they don't know where the data is coming from because it's been validated by GBIF. It's good data, they're just using it. And that means we're all participating in those processes, and people aren't qualifying like, well, you know, it wasn't a scientist who collected this, so maybe it's not as good. No, it's past muster, it's part of how we do science.
We're speaking with Tor Hansen. He's a conservation biologist and author of the new book, Close to Home, The Wonders of Nature, Just Outside Your Door. And before I forget, I just went to the iNaturalist website. It's iNaturalist, all one word, .org. And it's so much information there. It explains how it works and how our listeners can use this and now contribute to the citizen science world themselves here in Park City and elsewhere. I wanted to go back, though, because one of the scientists that we imagine, you know, was a world traveler and changed the face of science and biology that we know, it was Charles Darwin. But he also spent a lot of time doing research or experiments just in his backyard, too. I'm trying to remember the name of the book that was written about that years ago. But he recognized the value and the importance of learning about our world, his world, and just by in his own backyard.
Isn't that, it's a fascinating example, because here you have someone famous for, you know, his ideas about evolution that were developed in part from his travels, right? The Galapagos Islands and the finches and so forth. He spent years on the voyage of the Beagle, you know, circumnavigating the globe and making all of these observations. But it's a little, you know, less known is that Charles Darwin was a homebody. He never left England again. He didn't want to go anywhere. He got home from that trip And he, you know, had this wonderful estate where his family moved called Downhouse on, I think, about 19 acres out in the countryside, you know, to a little bit south and maybe a little bit west of London, you know, far enough away that it was very rural. And he spent the bulk of his career. He's famous for the voyage on the Beagle, but the bulk of his research, the bulk of the time that he spent developing those early ideas occurred in his backyard. Now, if you've got 19 acres on an estate with staff helping you, that's a hell of a yard. You can get a lot done. We don't all have that, but the point being, how much he saw from, you know, he studied earthworms in the yard. He and his kids tracked bumblebees around the yard. Where are they flying? What are they doing? Why do they keep coming back to this spot? What's going on? He had all these ideas. You know, he would see things on his walks. He had a path that he called the sand walk, where he would stroll and think, you know, and pace. And he would see, you know, mustard plants or things growing like that wasn't here before. Where did the seed come from? And he'd start these seed experiments. He had, you know, his greenhouses where he was growing plants and studying how they moved and looking at the pollination of orchids. He had a pond. So he's like, what, did the ducks move things from place to place? You know, can I put seeds through a duck and are they going to sprout again? So a lot of the research that he did and the data that he used to really build up his broader themes, it came from his yard. It really came right there from his backyard. And I love that combination of, yes, a world traveler, but someone who really appreciated the nature close to home.
And actually, the name of that book is Darwin's Backyard, How Small Experiments Led to a Big Theory by James Costa.
Yes, so, that's it. And it's a fabulous book. Highly recommend it.
We interviewed Mr. Costa several years ago.
Oh, good.
So, I know we only have a few minutes remaining. I want to talk about real quick the big news that the like in a backyard in Peru, the Altamayo. I know that's a big backyard, but again, going to the idea of there is so much yet to discover about our planet, you know, plants, animals, insects, marine life, birds, etc. The paper that came out about the Altamayo and all the species that were discovered there in such a short period of time, you know, a big backyard, but a backyard all the same in Peru.
Yeah, we don't. This is the thing. I think we have this idea, and it may be, you know, from our focus on, you know, the strides made by people like Darwin on their journeys and so forth. We have this idea that the age of exploration and biology was pretty much done by the end of the 19th century, forgetting the fact that scientists are describing over 2,000 new species a year right now. And many of those species are things that we didn't even have the ability to recognize before. You start looking at describing species of fungi that live inside plants and so forth. We didn't know that they were there. And then when we knew that we were there, we didn't know how to put a name on them. So we're still just scratching the surface just in naming the biodiversity of this planet, let alone figuring out what it's all doing.
Well, we could talk about this for a very long time, I am sure. But we do have to wrap up. Did you have one more question, Chris?
Well, I was just going to give the name of the book again. It's called Close to Home, The Wonders of Nature Just Outside Your Door. The author is Tor Hansen, conservation biologist. Tor, a website that people can go to learn more about you and all your other books.
Yes, that website is torhansen.net. That's torhansen.net.
Well, thank you so much for joining us again, Tor. We appreciate you.
My pleasure. Anytime, you guys. This has been a lot of fun.